From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, sitting in for Terry Gross. First Amendment lawyer Martin Garbus leads a dual life. He's a high-priced attorney whose corporate and criminal cases pay the bills and give him the freedom to pursue his other calling, designing new democratic constitutions for the nations of Eastern Europe. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Martin Garbus. Also today, Peter Marin talks with us about the moral basis for pacifism, nationalism, and war. And film critic Stephen Schiff tells us what he thinks of Sylvester Stallone's new movie, Oscar. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Bangladesh, opposition leaders are criticizing the government following Tuesday's cyclone, which killed at least 100,000 people. Opposition leaders claim officials responded too slowly to the disaster. Sam Miller filed this report for the BBC from Dhaka.
Sheikh Hasina said the government relief effort had been slow to get off the ground and had failed to reach some of the islands. She said the government hadn't taken the advance warning of a cyclone seriously enough. Small boats, she continued, should be sent with supplies to the most inaccessible regions, and paratroopers should be used to help evacuate some of the areas which have been totally destroyed. In reply, the Prime Minister, Begum Khalid Azia, insisted that at least some relief had been distributed everywhere. But, she said, many areas are still submerged, and this was hampering the relief effort. She said that in 1970, a smaller cyclone caused a larger number of deaths. This, she argued, showed how effective the relief operation had been this time.
Sam Miller reporting for the BBC. The State Department said today that the U.S. aid budget for disaster relief has already been stretched thin by the Kurdish refugee crisis and other humanitarian needs. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said the U.S. was looking for ways to address a request for helicopters to aid victims of the Bangladesh cyclone. She said the government was stretched by other commitments. Tutwiler said the U.S. contribution to Bangladesh so far was just over $2 million. She said that the U.S. gives Bangladesh $139 million a year for disaster preparedness, agriculture, and other programs. President Bush visited a St. Louis public housing complex today to push for an $855 million proposal that would give public housing tenants the chance to manage and buy their apartments. Kathy Lohr reports.
The president told a few hundred rain-soaked tenants, their children, and management officials at Cochran Gardens that they've shown the nation what great things can be accomplished when people get an opportunity to take control of their communities. Bush said the system of government-run public housing in this country has not worked.
The system that warehouses people strips them of their very, very humanity. And I'm here to say, if the system's not helping build a better life, then we must change the system.
Bush's program is known as Project Hope, home ownership and opportunities for people everywhere. Bush said his goal is to have 1 million people buy their own homes by the end of 1992. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained a quarter of a point to close at 2938.86. Declines led advances by a slight margin in moderate trading. This is NPR. President Bush today denied rumors that he went to Paris in 1980 to negotiate with Iran on a deal to delay the release of American hostages until after the U.S. presidential election. The president declined to answer a follow-up question of whether he'd ever met with any Iranians. He angrily denounced the story as rumor-mongering. Allegations have resurfaced that members of the Reagan campaign tried to delay the hostage release in an effort to scuttle President Carter's re-election bid. The claims are repeated in a new book by former Iranian President Abul Hassan Banisadr and an article by former Carter staffer Gary Sick. Vehicular homicide charges were dismissed against a Florida man on trial for the death of his daughter. The 3-year-old died in an auto accident. She was not strapped into a child safety seat. Todd Rosenthal reports from Miami.
30-year-old Ramiro Rodriguez walked out of a Miami courtroom relieved to know that he won't have to go to jail, but still visibly shaken by the graphic testimony describing the August 1990 death of his 3-year-old daughter Veronica, who was sitting on her mother's lap during an accident and died when her head smashed against the car's windshield. After prosecutors completed their testimony, the judge hearing the case dismissed all charges against Rodriguez.
It is the opinion of this court that the evidence is insufficient to warrant a conviction for the offense of vehicular homicide.
Prosecutors say little Veronica would be alive today if she were strapped into a child safety seat. Rodriguez was the first parent ever in the U.S. charged with the murder of his child for failing to use one. For National Public Radio, I'm Todd Rosenthal in Miami.
The Pentagon announced today that General Dynamics Corporation has been awarded a $615 million contract to build the first of the new Seawolf attack submarines. The new submarine is designed to dive deeper, move faster, and run more quietly than current attack subs. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. This month, Viking Press is publishing Peter Matheson's In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. And much of the credit for the book's release goes to a crusading First Amendment lawyer named Martin Garbus. 8 years ago, Viking published Crazy Horse. It was a blistering account of government chicanery against the Indians at Wounded Knee, South Dakota. Soon after publication, though, Viking was slapped with double libel suits totaling almost $50 million brought by former South Dakota Governor William Janklow and FBI agent David Price. Pending the outcome of the suits, Viking pulled Crazy Horse from bookstore shelves. Late last year, Garbus and Viking defeated the libel suits. The book is now back on sale, but Garbus sees growing threats to the First Amendment and publishing freedom.
We won both cases. One should say something about winning and losing. We won, but the book wasn't in the bookstores for 7 or 8 years.
But isn't that Viking's decision, whether or not they want to continue selling it?
Well, it's Viking's decision, but I also represent, just as an aside, because it comes that Viking had another decision recently when the government tried to stop another book by a writer named Jeffrey Toobin, who was writing about Iran-Contra. And in that particular case, Viking decided to go ahead and publish the book and even keep it in the bookstores, notwithstanding the threats of criminal prosecution against Viking and libel suits, et cetera, et cetera. I think that very few responsible publishers would continue a book in a bookstore, let's say in the Janklow Price situation, with those threats of libel claims. Because if you keep publishing the book and if you keep distributing it, once you know what is allegedly wrong in the book or is it allegedly dishonest in the book, your exposure can increase enormously. Remember also, in the spirit of Crazy Horse, there were a lot of other people in the book whom Matheson did not treat easily. He treated very harshly other prosecutors and other judges who were involved in the series of trials that grew out of the Wounded Knee seizure back in 1973. So Viking's fear, justifiable fear, was that if Price or Janklow were successful, or seemed to be successful, then the suits would come out of the woodwork.
So what's the ultimate cost to Viking out of all of these legal battles?
Well, I think there's a cost to Viking that has to be measured in many different ways. Money is one cost. The other cost is suppressing a book, which is a cost to the American public. The other cost is people at Viking, editors, publicists, who are getting their testimony taken at different places in the country that they have to run around. In terms of dollars, over a period of 8 years, it cost Viking about $2 million. It's easy to portray this case as a victory for the First Amendment. The book is out. That's a major victory. But the fact is that the way the legal system in the United States works, libel laws, etc., this book couldn't be read for some 7 or 8 years. And I think, aside from the literary value of the book, what was in the book had a great deal to say about public issues and public events. And
now there's another public issue, another public event concerning the Iran-Contra scandal. And Jeffrey Toobin's book talks about that, and it also has produced a problem for Viking, right?
Yes. Jeffrey Toobin was a young lawyer, probably the youngest lawyer, on the Iran-Contra prosecution team. He worked with Walsh and
Lawrence Walsh,
who was the special prosecutor. And he worked there for several years, and he decided to leave about a year ago, and he decided to write a book about his experience. He came to Viking to publish the book. He had to get certain clearances from the CIA and other governmental agencies to make sure there was nothing confidential in the book. He got all those clearances. Walsh then said, you can't publish the book. And Walsh came to Viking and said, Viking, you can't publish the book that you have contracted for, and that if you do publish the book, you're going to be subject to criminal prosecution.
Now, you took a different tack on this case. You simply didn't act as defense for Viking, but you initiated your own suit, or for Viking, you initiated a suit.
Yes. If you just stand around and bow down to threats, books cannot get published for a long time, as Viking did in the first instance. Here we decided to walk into court and ask a judge to say, listen, here's the book. We don't think there's a problem with it. We want to publish it. You can't have government officials walking around the country telling publishers at any time that if you publish this book, there's going to be a threat of prosecution. So we walked into a federal court in New York. We went before Judge Keenan, and we said, Judge, we want basically a seal of approval for this book. Now, that had never been done before in the legal system, and there was some question about whether or not it could be done. And Judge Keenan said that we were correct. He said that there is nothing in the book that should not be made available to the public. What Walsh, the special prosecutor, had said was that there was private stuff that had to wait until he released his report. And he also said there was stuff in the book that would jeopardize present criminal prosecutions, including any possible criminal prosecutions against North.
Now, this is a trickier kind of question because many of the people who certainly would defend First Amendment rights are also very interested in seeing these prosecutions go forward from Iran-Contra. And after all, Mr. Tubin did sign certain confidentiality agreements, did he not?
He did, and you're raising a very good question. And yes, you have very substantial issues in this case. Namely, if I were to represent you, and if you were to tell me personal things, could I then go write a book about it? And there is an attorney-client privilege, and you do tell me things in confidence. And one can argue that Tubin, as a government lawyer, had that kind of relationship with the government. And you shouldn't have a government lawyer who can then go out and write a book. There's a larger issue to me. The larger issue for me is what happens if the government gets information, and it's the lawyer who gets the information, and the government misuses the information or mishandles the information. Does that lawyer have a right to bring that misuse to the public attention? Now, one of the things that happened in Iran-Contra was there was a decision not to prosecute Elliot Abrams. And in chapter 4 or 5 of the book, Jeffrey Tubin writes about that decision. And if you read the chapter, what I get out of the chapter, and everybody has to read it their own way, is that, in fact, Elliot Abrams did lie. And in fact, Elliot Abrams
did lie about
his role in the Iran-Contra affair. And that, as I read the book and as I understand the testimony, that Elliot Abrams could have been indicted for perjury. But ultimately, Walsh decides not to, or his staff decides not to. And it seems to me the inner workings of that decision are important and people should know about it. If it was someone other than Elliot Abrams, I have the feeling he would have been prosecuted. Now, Walsh didn't do it because he was leaning over to Elliot Abrams, but Walsh did it on the theory, according to the book, that Elliot Abrams would probably win the case because, for a variety of reasons. Now, that's a very good question, whether or not a prosecutor with someone like Elliot Abrams should by himself make that decision, because it's clear, A, that he violated the law, that he committed a criminal act, but given who Elliot Abrams is, given the kind of defense he could be expected to put in, given the fact that the case was tried in Washington, D.C., Walsh makes a decision that we will not get a conviction, and therefore he doesn't prosecute him.
And your argument then must be that the greater public good is served by explaining this whole procedure rather than protecting the procedure.
Yes. And I'm not saying Walsh did anything wrong, but people should know that I don't want to reach out. And I don't want to, get into extraneous issues, but I don't know if the mayor of Washington, if they had made a decision that this is a case where the man was guilty, but it'll beat the case, we shouldn't prosecute him. I don't know if you have the same thought process going on. Maybe you do. But it seems to me the public is entitled to know what goes on in the minds of prosecutors to some extent. I think there are very difficult issues here, and you've put your finger on it. Let's assume that Elliot Abrams is totally innocent. Now, if the New York Times or National Public Radio calls Elliot Abrams a liar, that's one thing. But if a prosecutor who has special knowledge of what goes on before the grand jury comes to that conclusion, that's very different. And that's much more harmful to someone like Elliot Abrams. So I can see the dangers of a book where a prosecutor is explaining why people are and are not indicted, right? If we saw this kind of book written by Roy Cohn in the McCarthy period, namely a book of all these people who should have been indicted and I was the prosecutor, one could see how that could destroy people's careers. So I think, you've put your hand on it. There are many delicate issues. And before I got involved to try to get the book published, I really did think about this to a great extent.
My guest is Martin Garbus. He's a lawyer. He specializes in First Amendment cases in this country. And he's been working with Soviet and Eastern European dissidents for many years. He's also involved in helping draw up a new constitution for Czechoslovakia. He has also represented Viking Press in a number of recent lawsuits. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. First Amendment lawyer Martin Garbus is my guest. He's been involved in free speech and human rights work for, well, at least 25 years. And at the moment, I gather, Martin Garbus, that you are one of a group of lawyers helping to write a new constitution for Czechoslovakia. How did that come about?
I was in Czechoslovakia in November of 1989. I had a sense I had been representing dissidents throughout the years. I had represented Andrei Sakharov, Sharansky, some of the Allende people when Pinochet came in, and also some dissidents in Central Europe. When the events started happening in Central Europe, I had gone over, I'd seen what happened, and I had a sense that in Czechoslovakia, starting in about October of 1989, that things would start to happen there. So I went over in November of 89, and we saw the revolution, the Velvet Revolution, emerge and start to happen. I was at the Civic Forum, which was Havel's group, as this was happening, and it was clear to me that they were going to need a new constitution, that Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia, as they change from a state-owned economy to a private economy, that is to some extent a function of constitutional change. In other words, what the laws say about all those things have meaning. Also, these countries were going to get involved in issues like free speech. These countries were going to get involved in issues, some of the issues we're talking about now. Can you stop classified information from coming out? Should public officials be able to sue for libel, et cetera? And a whole host of other issues. Perhaps the most important issues being, can you keep these various parts of countries together? In Czechoslovakia, the Czech part and the Slovak part, can you keep these parts of the countries together through constitution writing?
So where's the process of constitution writing right now?
I'm leaving tonight for Czechoslovakia. There is now a draft of a constitution that has been fairly carefully worked. I helped put together a group of lawyers from America, along with other people, and from Central Europe and from other parts of the world. For example, people like Pierre Trudeau, the former Prime Minister of Canada, who's also a constitutional law expert and who has had his own problems with separatism. And he has tried to figure out ways of holding a country together. And we then have had a series of meetings in Czechoslovakia and in Austria, and I've been to Poland and Hungary as a consultant with respect to many of those people who were there and talking to those people there about the kinds of problems they're facing. One problem that they're facing now, and it's a fascinating problem, and the legal implications are fascinating, and the question of how they move towards democracy and what does a democracy mean, they're now starting to deal with how do you treat the people who are former, let's say, CP members.
Communist Party members.
Communist Party members. Do you go after them? Do you have trials? Do you purge the government of them? Do you have witch hunts in a way? I think if one is interested in democracy in Central Europe, then one would hope that the innocent and the guilty would have a legal process by which they could prove their innocence. And by and large, many of these countries, East Germany, in a rush to punish, are not paying enough attention to the kinds of principles they say they want to have in the future.
You know, in your own book, Traitors and Heroes, you talk about your family. Your father came from Poland, had his back broken during a pogrom.
Yes.
And I think about your life. It's very high-profile stuff. You zip around the world. You do battle with the United States government and the governments of many other countries, Israel, South Africa, the Soviet Union, Chile. And the image you paint of your father versus the image you paint of yourself, he seems to have been a very retractive man. And I wonder about the differences in your lives.
Ah, well, we should hook my analyst into this conversation. Yes, I think that what happened with my father was that he was terrified. He was terrified by what he had lived through. And then during World War II, and I don't think I mentioned it in the book, he had 11 brothers and sisters, all of whom were killed in the camps. He had a mother and father who was killed in the camps. And my father walked around most of the day waiting for something terrible to happen to him. He was totally defenseless. He was waiting, even prior to World War II, the plight of the Polish Jews were that they were helpless before pogroms. And he was unable to stand up for himself. And I suppose what happened to me is not
he didn't even want anyone to know about himself in the way you describe it.
Right,
The worst thing to do was to raise your head above, above the water.
And I suppose what the difference between us, in a way, was I saw what that had done to his life. And, you know, I may now put it in intellectual terms, but it's clearly not. It's clearly psychological terms. Just a horror at what had happened to him and kind of a vow in out of my own psychological need that I would try and help other people, whether they be in South Africa, Chile, etc., to the extent that I could. And the whole question of, I mean, you haven't used a word, but I'll use the word only to knock it down. To some extent, running around as I do to different places, and the book talks about that running around. Yes, you have death threats, and yes, you have jailings. But at the end of the day, if you're an American lawyer in a foreign country, the probabilities are that you're relatively safe. So although there's a lot of movement and a lot of fear, I have never for myself really felt the fear. I have always felt that I had the luxury of representing people in other countries, Bangladesh or whatever, India, and I had the luxury of really going out on a limb on the theory that I could always get pulled back, or would have to get pulled back, because an American lawyer, there'd be a public outcry if anything happened to me.
How do you make a living?
I represent publishing companies.
So you do get paid for some of this work?
Oh, yes. The libel work, which we've talked about, I represent a variety of publishing companies. I represent a large number of authors. I also happen to do a good deal of criminal work. I happen to have a skill. I'm considered to be a very good trial lawyer. So that's a skill that can be lucrative. And what I try and do is balance my life to get paid for that skill, and at the same time use that to pay for the other things.
Again, in your book, Traitors and Heroes, you recount battles over the First Amendment from the turn of the century to the present. You spend a lot of time on the 1919 Red Scares and the enactment of the espionage laws. It seems better now than it was then.
Well, it seems better in some ways, and perhaps in other ways not so much better. I mean, it's better in that communism, the Red Scares, is not the issue, I don't think, today that it once was, although certainly with the Jesse Helmses of the world, it is. I think with respect to, let's say, obscenity, in my other book, I talked about representing Lenny Bruce and a lot of other obscenity cases, that's an issue that I thought was over until Mapplethorpe and Karen Finley and all those things resurrected those issues. I think there are cycles in the country, and I think right now you're seeing an anti-obscenity cycle, which is evocative of what happened at the Lenny Bruce days. You're not seeing a Red Scare days because the Red Scare is gone, but you are seeing other things. You're seeing prosecutions of blacks. You're seeing the cost of racism. In other words, the country pays attention to different things and therefore makes different martyrs and different victims.
Well, now, a lot of people are going to say, you know, First Amendment lawyers, they're always gloom and doom specialists.
Right.
If they weren't, they'd be out of business.
Well, I think that under the Warren Court days, First Amendment lawyers were not gloom and doom specialists. I think that if you look at the First Amendment, most people think of the First Amendment as protecting my right to speak. I don't think of that at all as it that way at all. And when I was talking about the libel cases and the Tubin cases, I think what the First Amendment really deals with is the audience's right to listen, the audience's right to hear material. So if one were to stop looking at the First Amendment issue as in the pocket monopoly of a few lawyers like myself and to serve the self-interest of a few people who want to speak, but if you looked at the First Amendment as an area where you're concerned about the masses of the people having an opportunity to read a good many things, then I think that should change the perspective of what the First Amendment is all about.
Well, a case like that seems to be underway in San Francisco right now. Recently, federal agents raided a half dozen pornography shops, basically. And it's an interesting kind of debate that has emerged there because it concerns certain people's right to have these materials rather than certain people's right to publish or write them. I wonder what you see going on, because I probably most listeners even right now would not like to hang their First Amendment commitments on pornography.
Well, I think that's a very important issue. Namely, if they are successful in San Francisco, and I think by and large the United States Supreme Court would uphold the view of the prosecutors in those cases. The court system in San Francisco, as it goes up to the federal court and then the United States Supreme Court, gets worse for those people who believe in the privacy of your room or apartment, you should be able to have whatever books you want and to do whatever you want. I think that this Supreme Court would probably take the view that even if there were a book there or some kind of conduct going on that no one else saw and that didn't harm anybody, that nonetheless you can't do it. So I think that this Supreme Court ultimately, and it'll come out of the San Francisco cases probably, will come down with a rule that merely because you're in your own apartment, you can't read or do certain things that you couldn't do in another context. And while I don't think they can go back on everything that the Warren Court did, it's clear thus far that in the criminal area and the libel areas, they're prepared to roll back the clock.
Martin Garbus is a First Amendment lawyer and an absolutist on the First Amendment who has carried cases that other people frequently would not have. Thank you for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air.
I'm Frank Browning, filling in for Terry Gross. Since the Gulf War, Peter Marin has been looking at the morality of war and the language of pacifism. Coming up, Peter Marin tells us where the arguments of the anti-war protesters fell short. And Sylvester Stallone's trying his hand at comedy in the new movie Oscar. Film critic Stephen Schiff tells us if Sly manages to pull it off. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. United Nations officials said today that individual countries are free to unfreeze Iraq's foreign assets to allow it to buy food. The opinion amounts to a partial easing of the UN's economic hold on Baghdad, NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
This week, Iraq asked permission to use $1 billion of its frozen overseas assets to buy food. Today, the Security Council's Sanctions Committee said individual countries could unfreeze Iraqi funds if they wish to. The decision makes it easier for Baghdad to get at its money, but whether countries will opt to release the money is unclear. One that won't is the United States, which has over $1 billion in Iraqi funds. Ambassador Alexander Watson said today that if Iraq needs money for food, it should use its domestic reserves.
And in our view, Iraq must have some liquid foreign exchange reserves on hand in country. It must have had them on hand on August 1st, because every country does.
The committee took no action on an earlier Iraqi request to be allowed to sell $1 billion worth of oil. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The Exxon Corporation today said it was withdrawing its offer of a $1 billion civil settlement reached in March over the Valdez oil spill. The company's action came a day after the Alaska House of Representatives rejected a 10-year deal to reimburse state and federal cleanup efforts. President Bush today tried to squelch rumors that the 1980 Reagan for President campaign negotiated to delay the release of American hostages held in Iran. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The alleged negotiations are known as the October Surprise. According to reports, the Reagan campaign feared that then-President Jimmy Carter might successfully negotiate the release of the hostages held by Iran. There are allegations that campaign manager William Casey, later to become Reagan's CIA director, tried to preempt the hostage release with his own negotiations by promising to send arms to Iran. The hostages were finally released the day Reagan took the oath of office in January 1981. Today, President Bush emphatically denied the allegation that he was involved in these negotiations.
Was I ever in Paris in 1980? Definitively, definitely, no.
Mr. Bush urged reporters to publish his denial in order to, in his words, put an end to the rumor mongering. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The U.S. ambassador to Israel today criticized Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. Ambassador William Brown warned the policy could endanger American aid to Israel. Brown's comments came 2 days after the Bush administration snubbed the Israeli housing minister on a visit to Washington. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrials rose a quarter of a point to 2938.86. Declines led advances by a slight margin. This is National Public Radio News. Britain's opposition parties today called for early general elections after the ruling Tory party did poorly in local elections yesterday. Initial results in town council elections show Labour gained control of 10 councils and the Liberal Democrats 17. The Tories lost control of 35 councils. Conservative Prime Minister John Major doesn't have to call parliamentary elections until next year. Opposition parties say a vote should be held in June. Polish writer Jerzy Kaczynski has been found dead in his New York apartment. He was 57. Don Matheson of member station WNYC has more on the author's work.
Kaczynski was known the world over for his bleak novels depicting the horror of the Holocaust. His best-known work, Being There, was published in 1971. It ridiculed how a mentally deficient man became a political celebrity. A movie based on the book starred Peter Sellers and Shirley MacLaine. His works, The Painted Bird and Steps, won major awards. Police say Kaczynski killed himself. His wife found his body in the bathtub of their Manhattan apartment with a plastic bag over his head. A suicide note was found at the scene. Kaczynski's wife says he was despondent over declining health and an inability to continue writing. For National Public Radio, I'm Don Matheson in New York.
U.S. military officers in southern Iraq say the last American troops there could begin leaving by Monday, although no date has been set. The U.S. Army camp in the border town of Safwan has cared for more than 11,000 refugees since early March. Saudi Arabia has now accepted the refugees. Since Sunday, the U.S. has been flying them to Saudi camps. The nation's unemployment rate improved last month. The Labor Department said today unemployment fell from 6.8% in March to 6.6% in April. The U.S. dollar rose against most foreign currencies because of the news. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. A few days after American bombers began dropping their payloads on Iraq, writer Peter Maron began a dialogue with himself on paper. Everywhere the news was distressing, the faces of evil omnipresent. Saddam Hussein, he was sure, was an evil man inflicting horrible suffering on his neighbors and on his own people. But were Americans not falling into the same trap? He looked at the anti-war protests, and he wondered whether their shrill smugness was so very different either. Over the last few months, Maron has continued working out his moral dialogues. He's gone back to Gandhi, to Tolstoy, to Camus, to Martin Luther King Jr. The dilemma we all must face, he believes, is that there is no escape from tragedy. Welcome to Fresh Air, Peter Maron.
Thank you.
Is that the case? Tragedy confronts us wherever we turn, whatever choice we make about war or peace, intervention or not?
Well, I'm not sure that I would use the word tragedy right off the bat. I think what concerned me about the war was the question of whether or not one could stake out a position equally critical of the Iraqi invasion and of our response to it. And what I found when I went back to look at the traditional pacifist and anarchist arguments on which I think a resistance to the war had to be based, I found that the really compelling and convincing arguments against war were made by those with a certainty based on religion, those who felt that God's words had directed them to resist violence and stand for peace and life so that they would feel comfortable as patriots who engage in war, they would feel that comfortable in resisting war.
Well, you say that in our national opposition to Hussein's aggression, in your writing, you say that in our national opposition to Hussein's aggression, that it is almost as though we've rediscovered our own submerged thirst for war. And, well, I suppose that now, in the aftermath of the war, it's almost as though we've taken a delight in that thirst for war.
Well, you see, that's the problem. I think what happens is there was provocation. There was the invasion of Kuwait. And then one began to wonder, each of us did, I'm sure, except for those who are blindly patriotic, about the appropriate response to such aggressive behavior. But then, once that decision was taken, once we as a nation decided how to respond, then you saw growing in the citizens and in the politicians, I think almost across the board, a hysteria of patriotism and a sort of moral blindness, which became as disturbing, seen close up, as anything the Iraqis had done. Where this left you, I think, was with a revulsion at the Iraqi behavior, but with a similar revulsion at the behavior of one's own nation. And the problem which then offers itself is there a moral or a political place to stand in which you can speak against both sides, as different as they are, in the name of some third system or foundation of value? Indeed, I kept looking for that among the protests against the war and sorrowfully couldn't find it, since the argument seemed to be rather tired, very shrill, somewhat hysterical and self-serving, but none of them seemed to be cutting to the very traditional heart of resistance to the nation state, to the blindness of patriotism, and to war itself. because what I feel is that the individual responses to the war, as powerful as they may have been for individual persons, never found the sort of compelling public eloquence or the kinds of rhetoric or convincing speech which would serve to convince others of the profound significance of the arguments being offered. I think what you see when you go back and look even as late as Randolph Bourne or Paul Goodman or Camus, you see a use of language which becomes almost in itself the alternative to the rhetoric and sloganeering of war. And the thing that I feel we've lacked in this country, and probably lacked even back in the 60s in that anti-war movement, were the kinds of sustained and profound arguments which might sway people who were already neutral or people who were disposed towards the war and then were convinced perhaps by something other than the violence of war itself that war might simply lead to more war rather than to peace.
Well, in your writing, I mean, you seem to acknowledge that to have failed to confront Hussein over the invasion of Iraq would also have had tragic consequences, that there was that to be a pacifist is not to be an innocent.
No. I think religious pacifists can feel innocent because they are doing God's bidding. I think secular pacifists make a gamble. That is, had one not gone to war with Iraq, we know this would have cost Kuwaiti lives and probably Iraqi lives. That is, any position one took on moral or political grounds was likely to leave you with blood on your hands. The pacifist gamble is that in the long run, resisting evil with something other than violence will lead sooner rather than later to the cessation of violence and the diminishment of evil. Certainly, in spiritual terms, that makes a certain amount of sense, but I think it also makes sense in secular and historical terms. If you look at the history of wars from simply from the 18th or 19th centuries on, you see that each massive war was an attempt to end war. Once you argue that you are becoming violent or waging war in order to establish peace, I think we have to understand in secular and historical terms that these are specious arguments and that war never leads to peace.
Well, certainly are those who have pointed out that with the apparent demise of the Cold War and the rise of regional wars, there have been more weapons sold and more people killed in something in the order of between 35 and 40 regional wars in the last decade than there were in any of the great conflagrations.
Well, you see, I think there's a basic question here, which is the one that interests me. Take a single person now, whatever their politics, whatever their ideology, who looks in each direction at the violence around them, looks at the behavior of the Iraqis, looks at the behavior of their own country, looks at the behavior of nation states in general, and now the sort of tribalism which has replaced in many places the nation state. If you look at this with a sort of clear or childhood eye, there is simply something insane or crazy about it. It makes no sense. It makes no sense to the individual heart, makes no sense to the individual conscience or soul. The question which then arises is there an appropriate response from an individual who finds the whole system which surrounds him or her insane and who can find nothing in it which corresponds to their moral imagination or what their soul whispers to them in the dark of the night about what's possible for humans or what would make a home in the world for flesh? I think that's the point at which you have to begin. You have to take a half step outside what seem like the imperatives of history and raise the question for yourself, if all of this seems crazy to me, what should I do about it, or where can I stand?
Well, you speak again of the lone man in Tiananmen Square facing down the tank of the Chinese Red Army, that it was a moment like that of seeing this man's flesh against the power of the state that moved much of the world.
Yes, I think it's precisely there that a secular morality begins. That was almost an ideogram for what it is I'm trying to describe here. We all saw on our screen the machines of war, with their immense and obscene power, the power of authority, the power of the state, and the power of the machine itself, the power of technology, set over and against the pure, simple fact of the single living creature or the flesh itself. And how many among us would not, seeing that ideogram as it was acted out, side with the single living creature as opposed to the tank or the persons in the tank? We know almost instinctively, if not instinctively, which side one is to be on. So what happens if you begin to extend that? And now you have our bombers rather than the tanks, and you have the hundreds of thousands of young conscripted Iraqi soldiers, many of them simply teenagers, dug into their trenches, and the planes flying over and over and over again, destroying then those young men. It's not clear to me how different that is as an ideogram or an image or a fact of life or war from the tank and the single human creature. It seems to me if we begin with that single human creature, then some of us will decide that in every instance where power is arrayed against vulnerability, where machines are arrayed against flesh, where authority is arrayed against the single human soul, that we are duty-bound, not just through the spontaneity of our reaction, but through a morality thought through and hard won, to side with the creature, with the flesh, against the machine and against the state and against the powers of war.
My guest is Peter Maron. He's a writer, and he's been thinking a lot about war lately. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Peter Maron is my guest. He's a writer in Harper's Magazine and other places, currently a fellow of the Alicia Patterson Foundation. He's been working on a long piece about the search for a basis for morality and for pacifism in this country. You don't deny all violence, though. You don't, for example, you say in your writing, you say you don't necessarily deny the occasional necessity of personal violence to combat evil.
Well, what I say in the piece actually is the fact that I would refuse, and indeed did refuse as a young man, to take the orders of my nation state in terms of who to kill or not kill or when to go to war or when not to go to war. I can't say, though that kind of refusal comes easily to me, I can't say that leads me automatically to the position that I would never personally be violent to defend my family or my house or perhaps even my nation. I say two things in the piece. One is that the question of violence, like the question of good and evil, like the question of fidelity, like the question of honesty, is a lifelong individual struggle for each one of us. And the fact that one opposes violence in principle or has, in a sense, decided or taken an inward vow to try to deal with it or avoid it, doesn't mean that one can predict one would avoid it at all times. Secondly, I say in the piece that I don't have any trouble understanding that two people of equally goodwill could confront the question of violence in relation to politics and freedom and come up with different answers. Certainly, I'm quite able to have respect for a person on the other side who thinks through this issue clearly and carefully and then says, well, as much as I hate to say it, I think that violence here is the only way. This leads us right back to the question of tragedy, because I think it's possible for the person who comes down on the side of nonviolence to say, I am fully aware that this refusal of violence, this refusal to go to war may indeed have tragic consequences, not so much for me, but for other persons. And I think then that the person who comes down on the side of violence has to be able to say, well, I think I'm able to come down on the side of violence, but I understand that this too will have tragic consequences. I am not comfortable with anybody on either side who is absolutely certain of their position. And I am very comfortable with people on both sides who think through their position and then take a stance with a certain sense of terror at the fact that they have no way of knowing what the real consequences of their stance will be. In a certain sense, the people who have that sense of moral terror, the people who live with a sense of tragedy, no matter which side they're on, are in a way allies.
Because they know that they will all have dirty hands.
They know something about being human, which is that nobody is more pure than anybody else, and that all of us in the long run will do some good and some evil.
My guest has been Peter Marin. We've been talking about a work in progress on searching for the roots of morality in America and in the world. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us from All Things Considered. What's on the news this afternoon, Robert?
Well, news, Frank, of deaths now from disease in Bangladesh, perhaps cholera, dysentery, caused by the shortage of water after the terrible cyclone. Also from New York, news of the death, apparently the suicide, of the writer Jerzy Kaczynski. And we'll have the concluding report of our series on the homeless mentally ill. Today, a look at Creedmoor State Mental Hospital, where there used to be 10,000 patients. Today, like so many state hospitals, it's reduced down to only 1,000, and a residence for the mentally ill in Manhattan.
Thanks, Robert. Those and other stories coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sylvester Stallone has been Rocky in the ring and Rambo in the jungle. In his new movie, Oscar, Stallone ventures into new territory, farce. Stephen Schiff has this review.
Farce is the kind of knockabout comedy that usually involves mistaken identities, switched suitcases, and lots of the wrong people popping through the wrong doors. And most people either love it or hate it. For a long time, American moviegoers loved it. Farce was one of the bases on which Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd built their magisterial comedies. And when the sound era arrived, some of the very best movies were farces. The great romantic comedies of Ernst Lubitsch, for instance, and the brilliant screwball comedies of the 30s, and the dazzling 40s masterpieces of Preston Sturges. But that was before realism became the linchpin of American cinema. Farce depends on the suspension of disbelief. But the movies soon trained their audiences to demand instant and complete belief in everything they saw, which meant that farce went back to the theater where it had started, and those few movie makers who still loved the form fell on hard times. Billy Wilder gave up completely. Blake Edwards soldiered on with extremely patchy success. And Sylvester Stallone... Wait a minute. Did I say Sylvester Stallone? Well, yes. And no, I'm not insisting that the Rocky films were actually farces, not intentional farces anyway. I'm talking about his new movie Oscar, which is based on a French stage play from the 60s and which feels weirdly like a French stage play from the 60s, even though it's about an all-American gangster in the 30s. Stallone plays Snaps Provolone, the biggest, meanest racketeer in town, only now he's trying to go legit, trying to throw his lot in with some hoity-toity bankers. Meanwhile, Provolone's bookkeeper is in love with his daughter, and he even gives Provolone a bag of jewels in exchange for her hand. Only it turns out the girl the bookkeeper loves isn't Provolone's real daughter, and the bag of jewels gets switched with a bag of underwear, which then gets switched with a bag of money, which, well, here are Provolone and his goon Connie, played by Chaz Palminteri, trying to get everything straight.
Snaps, are you sure there was cash in that bag?
Yeah, little Anthony stole it.
If little Anthony stole it, then he's got it.
No, you blockhead, he stole it, then he gave it back to me.
Why'd he give it back to you?
To buy back the jewels.
What jewels?
The jewels he stole from me.
He stole jewels from you too?
Yeah, so he could marry my daughter.
Lisa.
Not Lisa, Teresa.
How come nobody's never met this daughter, Teresa?
Because she's not my daughter, capiche?
Yeah, Your daughter's not your daughter. And the cash that used to be the jewels is now your underwear.
Now you got it.
I got it. I don't even know what I'm talking about.
That's mostly how it goes in this movie. A lot happens, there's a lot of carefully calculated confusion, and unfortunately, there's hardly a single funny moment. The screenplay is fancy without being genuinely witty, and John Landis's direction plods. But the main problem is that neither Stallone nor most of the rest of the cast knows how to play farce. Farce requires a masterly, over-the-top style, but Stallone and company merely mug. Of the main players, and there are dozens of them, only Tim Curry, as Provolone's elocution teacher, has the requisite verve. And he's reduced to limply punny lines about the thug who left his participle dangling, whereupon said thug looks sheepishly down at his fly. As for Stallone, well, I don't know what the future holds. Audiences are tired of his action movies, and as a comic actor, he's never much more than genial, presentable. Anyone looking for a game show host with terrific pecs?
Film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. The interviews on Fresh Air are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers. Naomi Person produces the arts reviews. They are assisted by Joan Tui, Roberta Chirac, and Robbie Harris. Danny Miller is our senior producer, Dorothy Farabee our administrative assistant, Ellen Silva does our research, Tracy Hildebrandt is our intern, and Joyce Lieberman, our technical director. Fresh Air is directed by Chris Spurgeon. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Terry returns next week. I'm Frank Browning.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Exene Cervenka is a poet turned songwriter and singer. She started performing in the 70s with X, a band that rose from the Los Angeles underground to national fame. On the next Fresh Air, a concert of songs by Exene Cervenka. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.